This episode is sponsored by Brilliant. The world may be a sphere, not flat, but as we'll see today, a flat Earth is a pretty cool place to live. So today we return to the Megastructures series to look at how and why you'd build a flat or flat-ish planet, as well as a few interesting variations on it. Now before we delve into the topic, I should note that we'll be assuming that gravity is being provided by classic use of mass, not centrifugal spin, as we often use for rotating habitat examples, or any high-tech type of artificial gravity like we so often see in science fiction. With that in mind, our options for construction are limited to using ultra-strong material, or what we call active support, which is basically pushing on something to keep it from falling down. We've discussed both many times, so we'll mostly bypass it today, but if you're new to the channel, you may want to jump over to the Upward Bound series or the early Megastructures episodes for a more detailed explanation. Building a flat planet, often called a disk world, is decidedly tricky even by the very high standard of building an artificial planet to begin with, and even the simplest of these would dwarf any engineering project humanity has ever taken on, and to the same degree, our planet dwarfs such projects. However, it's not really a scientific challenge or super high tech, just a matter of brute force, to which more technology would doubtless help. This episode is not about the flat Earth theory. I tend to take for granted anybody watching SFIA assumes our world is a sphere, so it would be preaching to the choir. But the various problems with that theory are also some of the problems we have to overcome to make such a planet have conditions that are either Earth-like or improvements to conditions on Earth, so we will look at some of them. That's a good place to begin, though. When you're getting ready to pile vast amounts of matter in place to make an artificial world, we tend to assume you go with a sphere, like Earth, as it's the version that's going to give you the maximum living area for unit of mass. That's true enough, but contains three flawed assumptions. First, it doesn't actually give you the maximum surface area for volume of mass. In fact, a sphere has the lowest surface area per volume of any object. But what's generally meant in this context by saying living area is something with Earth-like gravity, which is to say, around as strong as Earth at any point on the surface, and pointed down at the ground. On a sphere, gravity always points down and perpendicular to the surface. On a cube or a disk, they do not. We also mean a place that gets enough light and warmth from the sun. And here's our second bad assumption. If I live on a rotating sphere like Earth, I have twice the land surface as a disk of the same radius, and the latter has pi r squared for area on each side, so 2 pi r squared for both sides, while a sphere has a surface area of 4 pi r squared, double a disk. Both receive the same total sunlight, assuming your disk remains stationary and perpendicular to the sun's rays. If your disk spins to receive light on both sides, it will often receive less due to being slanted. It will also have the same amount of light hitting every part of one side of that disk, whereas we get less light near our poles, which are tilted away from the sun. Now, you don't have to light one of these artificial worlds with a classic star, but if you are, it has some advantages and disadvantages, because while a flat planet gets the same light everywhere, a spherical one loses a lot of real estate to being too hot or too cold. When you build a flat planet orbiting a star, the whole thing has mostly the same climate, meaning you have less real estate, but you can use every little bit of it. The third flawed assumption is that you actually care about how much mass you are using. It takes far more mass to make a classic mass gravity planet than a spin gravity one of the same living area, by many orders of magnitude, which we covered the specifics of in the episode Mega Earths. So if you're making a spherical planet, it already implies you aren't trying to optimize that. If you're already using a million times more mass to build a spherical planet instead of swarms of rotating habitats of an equal living area, going up to 2 million times isn't that big a deal. Now you might say that highlights a problem right there. You wouldn't build these natural gravity worlds because they are mass wasteful. Except they are not. They are not expending mass, they are storing it, and it doesn't matter what kind of mass it is. Earth mass is about 6 zettatons, mostly iron, oxygen, silicon, and magnesium, but to produce gravity, 6 zettatons of hydrogen and helium work just as well, and they are each far more abundant than every other element combined. The only source of gravity more abundant is dark matter, and if we ever figure out a way to capture and store that, it would work too. Hydrogen is very valuable to civilizations that run on fusion, be it artificial fusion or from a star. You need to store it somewhere, and a big spherical or disc-shaped tank that you've slapped a layer of dirt, water, and air around works just fine. You'd have to haul it out of a gravity well, but the energy released by fusing a kilogram of hydrogen is so much more than the energy needed to lift it out of an Earth-like gravity well that it can be disregarded, and you could have derived a similar amount of power from it while dropping it down that well in the first place. When you're storing hydrogen gas for billions of years, it's very likely to leak out if the gravity pull isn't much higher than the kinetic energy of those hydrogen atoms in your containment vessel. So while you'd expect most folks to live inside cylinder-shaped rotating habitats, you'd also expect a proportionally small, but still large number of these kinds of artificial planets that use natural mass-based gravity as it serves as both storage and living area. What the filler is would vary. It might be their fuel reserves or their temporary trash cans too. By default, we assume advanced civilizations use hydrogen turned into helium for energy. And helium is actually a pain to use for gravity because you have to build very large to overcome its low density. But they might be able to fuse helium into carbon or nitrogen or oxygen, or even go all the way up to iron, which is great for building smaller, natural gravity planets as it's very dense. Of course, they might feed matter right into black holes for power production, in which case it doesn't matter what type of matter you use. We'll discuss many other advantages of flat planets as we go, but think of it this way. If you're storing huge amounts of raw material someplace, you might as well get some extra use out of it by living there. And if you're engaging in the kind of stellar engineering we discuss for things like star lifting, or extending a sun's lifespan, especially the latter, you are going to end up with tens of thousands of planets worth of excess mass, whose value is huge, but only in the context of being able to use it billions of years from now, which makes it perfect for a planetary storage system. Now, if you go fill a giant hollow planet with gas, you can actually rely on pressure to hold the surface up, like a balloon, for certain sizes and pressures anyway, or some super strong firmament material if you had it, but you'd usually end up using a big spherical shell made out of overlapping orbital rings. See that episode for details, or again, mega-Earths. For non-spherical planets, you pretty much have to do this anyway, because on a flat, thick disk of a planet, gravity only points down at the middle. As you move out from the center, it will start tilting toward the center instead of straight down. And left to its own, you'd end up seeing the disk deform to have a bulge in the middle, what we call a pancake planet, and eventually turn into a sphere. A pancake planet has some advantages too. You have a horizon on one from the curvature. On a strictly flat planet, you do still have an effective horizon, as the light traveling through all that air will get blurry and bent, but it's a long way off. Interestingly, on a big enough disk world, like an Alderson disk, a version billions of times bigger in area than Earth, you would have to consider the effect of gravity on the light too. If someone far off points a laser your way, the beam will curve down and hit the ground before reaching you. But, if they angle it up a bit, it would curve down and reach you, like throwing a ball which follows a parabolic trajectory. That would seem to give a horizon, but that whole disk will have light heading up at angles too, which will curve down and reach you, so that even though you are standing on a flat surface, it will seem to curve up. We'll discuss Alderson disks another day. For our more modest flat planets, if we want gravity to point straight down, we have to distribute our mass differently and not uniformly. To avoid that slanty effect as you move out from the center, you need to increase the amount of mass under you as you go. Though you can also spin the planet like a carousel to get centrifugal force, which would push out, helping to counter the central mass, and it will rise as you move out from the center too. Imagine for the moment our flat planet was made of many concentric rings, each a bit more massive than the next, growing as you move to the edge. We will also spin it, and we will balance the whole process out for whatever combination best achieves a mostly uniform gravity, pointing more or less downward. It need not be perfectly uniform either. Earth's gravity isn't, after all. It's lower or higher depending on your altitude and latitude, and it does angle near mountains and cliffs, which pull you a bit sideways. Now, since I raised those rings, let's take a moment to remind everyone what an orbital ring is. An orbital ring is a hollow ring around a planet that is basically stationary relative to the planet's surface. Inside it is a vast amount of matter spinning around faster than normal orbital speed, and the net momentum of the hollow, stationary part and the inner spinning part add up to whatever the appropriate momentum would be for an object of that total mass to orbit. Visually, think a big long hose wrapped in a circle with water spinning around that loop. And again, see the Orbital Rings episode for the specifics on that. We call that active support, and we have a few types besides that discussed in Space Towers and Launch Loops and some other episodes, but we'll focus on the Orbital Ring. We will make a ton of them, each a bit wider in diameter, laid out as a disk. We will pump a huge amount of matter through them, probably hydrogen or helium, which we've compressed to a high density. So it's a good chance it's metallic hydrogen, which is handy if those rings are using magnets or superconductors to keep the mass spinning. You would increase the density in each subsequent ring so it had more mass, or put more rings below them. Two quick notes. If for some reason you can't compress your hydrogen or helium enough to keep things decently flat for a coin-shaped disk to live on, rather than a thick cylinder you'd live on the caps of, you do have a couple of options. First, you can use artificial black holes instead. Those do have magnetic fields you can push on them with, and they could orbit inside a hollow tube just fine. Second, if you got to make it deeper as you go out, you can opt to make it taller instead, sloping your world up near the edges, rather than the middle like the pancake planet. Those sloping sides, like a bowl, let you add more mass and also tilts the gravity more outward, counteracting the slant toward the center. Some folks might object to living over the top of a bunch of black holes or ultra-compressed hydrogen, but just as a reminder, we all live on top of a vast, molten, radioactive ball of metal. The solid part we live on, the crust, is about as thick and sturdy as that nasty skin that forms on top of hot soup or pudding. Assuming you can get those materials in the ring dense enough, you can go ahead with your entirely flat planet at this point. Otherwise, you might need some curved geometry, and we'll discuss a few other fun options later. Your next step, though, is to lay down a normal layer of artificial land and sea. And this is obviously no easy process, but in terms of effort per living area, this phase is no harder than terraforming planets or building rotating habitats. Your flat Earth has no real horizon, but it's still better than a rotating habitat in that regard, where the ground curves up and your neighbor's backyard hangs over your head. Here it just goes on forever until interrupted by air interference and blur, or landscape. That's another trick for handling gravity slanting issues too. You can build mini layers of circular mountain ranges whose extra mass yanks material toward them, keeping air and water from drifting off too much, breaking up horizons, and letting you tilt land to match slants with less of an issue. An extreme form of this is the ripple world, where it just moves outward like a wave of peaks and valleys from the center, differing from a ripple caused by dropping a stone in a pond, in that the further out from the center you get, the higher those waves would be, rather than attenuating off in amplitude or height. The planet would still look rather flat from a distance, but to those living on it, there'd be more natural landscape curvature. Playing with the landscape this way also helps break up the weather and climate. Again, a flat planet has the same lighting and temperature everywhere on a given side, and while you might prefer that over land wasted on equatorial hotspots and frozen poles, a little variety would be nice. Speaking of lighting, that's the next big issue. Now, unlike the flat Earth theory, our flat planet can just be orbiting the sun and spinning like a coin for day and night. And we can tilt it too so it has seasonal variation. The sun would otherwise rise and set just like normal, Twilight and dusk are a bit different, but there is still a horizon in this regard for it to rise and set across, and you'd still get that noon blue and twilight red. However, such constructs require huge amounts of effort and energy that you likely can only afford in scenarios where you can mimic the sun anyway, via artificial fusion, or huge mirrors or Kugelblitz black holes. So we might prefer to go the Flat Earth approach on this one. In the Flat Earth theory, the sun is not a giant, far from Earth and nearly a million times more massive. It and the moon are fairly tiny objects that just circle over the Earth, about where the equator is, a circle about halfway out from the center of the disk, with the North Pole at the center, and the South Pole as a circle on the rim, both far from the sun and moon. Now this begs the question as to why the sun does not fall down. As I recall, under Flat Earth theory, this is because gravity is much weaker and diminishes faster than in Newtonian physics, somewhat akin to an extreme form of MOND, modified Newtonian dynamics, that sought to explain dark matter as a false positive caused by gravity getting weaker faster than the inverse square at very large distances. We are assuming throughout this episode that gravity works more or less like Newton and Einstein said it does, and that we have no artificial way of messing with it beyond piling up mass somewhere or spinning things very fast. In this case, though, we are obviously not dealing with a typical star, so we need not assume it's that massive. Such an object needs to be putting down around 200,000 terawatts on our flat Earth, assuming it's got the same land area as Earth, and presumably be about 30 kilometers in diameter to be about the same size as the sun or moon in the sky, if about 3,000 kilometers above the equator, implying that each square meter of that sun disk object was giving off about 7 gigawatts of power. Imagine for the moment that our sun here was a big flat mirror, or solar sail, and that we were beaming lasers or light beams at it, that it bounced back down to the flat planet below. If you've seen the Interstellar Laser Highways episode, or any of the ones we discussed laser propulsion spaceships in, you might remember it takes either 3 gigawatts of laser per ton absorbed, or 1.5 gigawatts when bounced instead, to accelerate an object at 1G, or hold it stationary against Earth's gravity. We'd have enough power per unit area here, 7 gigawatts per meter squared, for a very thick mirror, indeed one thicker than battleship armor rather than the thin foil we normally think of for solar sails and mirrors. So that part at least is easy. Such a fake sun can be held up either by its own internal power generation or by light it is reflecting from the true source. That's also more than enough energy to let you steer the thing around in a circle. Similarly, a big internal fusion plant could be grabbing up trace atmosphere to superheat and use as exhaust. One problem is that for that size and power, your black body spectrum corresponds to more than twice the sun's surface temperature, which is obviously a problem for building an object to generate this, since it would melt it to slag, and also be generating a lot more ultraviolet light than we'd like. Not as big a deal for mirrors though, since they'd be reflecting most of the light away, not absorbing it, and are of course mechanically simple, so can better handle heat anyway. Now conveniently, a black hole producing this amount of energy via Hawking radiation only masses 40 kilotons, and even using just a small portion of that as thrust would be enough to keep it aloft. However, it would only live a couple months, so you'd have to be constantly feeding it. You'd probably use many of them clumped together with more mass, longer lives, and less power output. You'd also need to surround it with something that could absorb all that gamma radiation and spit it out as normal light, same as our sun actually does. We'll discuss this more in Making Suns early next year, where we'll look at both building the natural kind and all sorts of pseudosuns we can make via artificial power sources or black holes. But for the moment, we'll just say the mirror approach is probably the best one for doing this variety of lighting, where the sun spins around over a flat planet, and you'd probably fake the moon the same way, or moons if you wanted to. You also need another sun on the other side, unless you want to waste half your flat Earth's potential living area. The other option, which we'll also discuss more in Making Suns, is a sun-moon, the classic geocentric one where the sun is a moon-sized object orbiting the planet. Couple caveats first. For any given object, there's only one distance in terms of orbits that is going to produce a 24-hour orbit, which can be a pain for getting your sun in the right place. We can counter that by spinning the planet too, with the sun, moon, or backwards. For instance, if the sun did orbit the Earth every 24 hours, it would hang in the same place because the Earth spins that fast. That's a geostationary orbit. Alternatively, if the planet spun backwards, in such a case the sun would take less time to re-illuminate the same place. So we can do the same thing with a flat Earth to widen our options. But you can't spin such an object very fast. Indeed, that's one of the problems with using the real sun for lighting, if you try to make these places much bigger than Earth-sized, too much centrifugal force on the sides. If you want to scale a disk world up, you need to make it an ellipse instead of a circle, so you can spin it relative to the sun, without getting extreme forces near what I suppose we will call the equator. You might do that for one with a sun moon too, since an orbit around a big disk is not quite the nice circle or ellipse that it is for a sphere, especially a disk with a non-homogeneous distribution of mass. Now your fake sun gives a lot more of its light to your planet, proportionally, than ours does, but it still wastes a lot of it by radiating omnidirectionally, so you'd probably have a big spotlight or parabolic dish arrangement for your sun, rather than a uniform light bulb. And that helps a lot for trying to get the fake sun to be the right size and orbital rate and brightness and spectrum. You could also use the same tricks as with the hovering sun from earlier though, since all that power can be used as thrust to let you get around the normal orbital mechanics for time and distance. Of course, you can circumvent all of this by just having giant lights overhead that switch on in sequence to fake a moving sun, or using a big spaceship that flies around lighting you with its engines, sort of like Helios and his sun chariot from Greek mythology. Heck, it might even land in some sea on the rim to refuel with water for thrust and hydrogen fusion fuel every night. Seems kinda crazy as a very extreme effort, these sorts of things, but keep it in context. You just built a whole planet shaped like a pizza, which dwarfs this type of fake sun building. Okay, that's the basics. Let's add some options for variation or adding these things together. One of these is a roulette world, where like a roulette wheel, it bulges up on the rim and the middle. Actually, this is one of the variations used for the flat Earth theory, and it gives you better horizons and better light distribution if you're using that hovering but circling sun approach. It's also much easier to build, since you can have a central mass and a lot of other mass orbiting normally in a hoop around it. Then just build a layer over top, curved to keep gravity perpendicular to the ground. You can later expand this with more rings to create the ripple world we mentioned earlier. With any of these, you also have to decide what to do with the sides or rim of the planet. You can let it flatten off as a straight disk you'd sail over the edge of, but you wouldn't fall forever, and depending on how you did your lighting and mass distribution, this might be a forbidding dark frozen wasteland, or just a curved rim, maybe habitable. Unless you're building much smaller than Earth, there's no need to have rim walls for retaining air or keeping things from falling off, as gravity still pulls on everything, not just straight down relative to the ground. And of course, so long as it's lit, this area, the edge of the coin, is entirely habitable with gravity pointing the right way. Curve it, and it has horizons too, and you can just walk, sail, or fly around it to the other side. Assuming we're using one lit by our own sun. Again, you can't just spin it on a side, and so long as it's not too big, you don't have to worry about it flicking people off the nominal equator. So don't build one bigger than a gas giant, unless you also want to start distributing your mass non-homogeneously in that way too. Which you can do. Orbital rings aren't the only trick for that, and need not be circles anyway. You can use what we call an atlas pillar, for instance, too, which is essentially a space tower, a straight structural member in which accelerated matter shoves at the ends to give it an arbitrarily high compressive strength. One can think of these as orbital rings of very high eccentricity. See the Space Towers episode for details. As to arrangements, if you're providing your own lighting or using beamed-in light off a big hovering mirror, you can put these anywhere you please, But if you want them using the sun, then you'd put them in a big ring around the sun out as far as Earth. You could pack in tens of thousands of them in one orbital plane, which is also about all you'd have the mass for if you were stealing that mass mostly from the sun via starlifting. And of course you'd need to go in closer as the sun would have gotten a bit dimmer as you stole its mass and extended its life. Since they are flipping around, a lot of that sunlight would be wasted, so you'd probably put a big thin ring ward covered in solar panels behind them, or maybe a variation on the rung ward we discussed in Dyson spheres. There's some weird tricks you can do to allow you to travel easily, maybe even walk, between such collections of planets, but we'll discuss those another time too. As to why you'd ever build such things, it's worth remembering that any civilization that can build such things is one powerful enough to justify the efforts simply by saying, because we can. However, as mentioned earlier, they do serve an actual purpose. You can store mass in many ways, but if your civilization is going in for the long haul, you do need huge reserves of mass, and ones that can reliably be kept securely for astronomically long times. Quite possibly more than an entire solar mass, as your home system might be grabbing additional material from nearby systems. Most storage spots would probably be spherical shell wards, and they'd only be a small fraction of the places people lived, but there's no real major downside to using other geometries that would prevent you from doing some for novelty value. A flat Earth is going to be a major tourist attraction, and one which conveniently has good weather everywhere on it. No polar or equatorial variation, so you could cover it with tons of archipelagos of snaky islands and beach resorts, for instance. For that matter, you could also recreate Earth-like deep oceans, something that is very hard to do with rotating habitats. So this is an example of a type of megastructure and artificial planet that you wouldn't build a lot of, but which you probably would build some of. So while in the past, folks often incorrectly believed the Earth was flat, in the future, there will probably be folks who would say that and be correct. It does make me wonder, though, if any of those folks living on a flat Earth might create conspiracy theories that they actually lived on a sphere. It's going to be a long time before we're building artificial planets, but they do seem to serve a practical purpose, not just the stuff of daydreams. Of course, they already do. We often use weird geometries like flat or cube or hoop-shaped planets for teaching students how to master working with gravity. And if you're going through the episode today wondering about other strange geometries and how you calculate their gravity, or just want to improve your math and physics skills, head over to Brilliant.org. Brilliant focuses on teaching you practical knowledge at your own rate, but they know that to learn the material, it helps to have a lot of fun examples. And one of those is the Flat Earth Quiz that walks through the math and concepts involved. If you want to increase your own understanding of that topic or others, and have fun while you're doing it, go to brilliant.org/IsaacArthur and sign up for free. And also, the first 200 people that go to that link will get 20% off the annual premium subscription. We'll get to our schedule in a moment, but as a reminder, we have our end-of-the-month live stream coming up tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, and I hope to see you then. Next Thursday, we'll be back to the Upward Bound series for a look at kickstarting space industry, and we'll review some of the options that might be what get us into space in a big way. The week after that, we'll make a trip to the North Pole and Antarctica to look at the ways we might transform the cold regions of our own planet into livable places. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel and hit the notifications bell. And if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching and have a great week.